accession number 18262, Reel 8.
Carter Reels 8.
When we threw the entrails into the water, the Koreans were 100 yards down the river, waiting and collecting all the entrails. I suppose it was a bit of a party for them because, as I said, they don't eat meat, probably once a year. Anyhow, getting back to the dogs, how I know they hung them. Early one morning, we could hear these dogs howling. And we thought, well, they're in trouble, they're in agony, they sounded in agony. And below us was this large concrete bridge that I crossed to go towards the blacksmith. And on this bridge, there were three large dogs hanging over the bridge, over the water, and howling. And we protested over this because in England, we don't eat dog meat. But in Korean, I suppose it's common, like they say, it's common for them to eat dog meat. And we protested to the Chinese over this, saying that it was cruel and things like that. And they went to the town of Chongsung and told all the peasants not to hang their dogs in the close proximity of the camp so that we could see and hear them. And we stopped it. They stopped it.
Why did they hang them?
They hung them, they reckon they hung them because what it done, it whitened the meat of the dog. This is what they told us. How it whitened them, I don't know. But it caused the blood to run to one end of the dog, I suppose, and the rest of the meat turned white after they'd skinned it. But that was the only way they killed the dog. They hung them. All dogs were hung in Korea. And that was the way they done it. I mean, it was barbaric to us, but to them it was a natural thing. They did it all the time. Oh, dear. Can you switch it off?
Did you ever get any visits by Westerners?
Ah, yes, I did. We did. There was a group came round from the International Law Commission, yes. And they came round to all camps to see if there was any atrocities being done and things like that. And they asked us, they had a desk on the square, and we had to go up there, and they asked you all sorts of questions. Are you being ill-treated or anything like that? Are you being provided with food? But they never asked us the amount of food, you see. We said, yes, well, you couldn't tell lies. We were provided with food. And they'd write all this down. And off they went, and we never heard any more of that. There was about six or eight of them. And they were interviewing everyone in all the camps. Later on, another group came round, which were accusing the Americans of using germ warfare. They came around with an exhibition of a case of a metal bomb that split in half, stating with pictures and things like that, showing us the germ warfare, stating that they'd been dropping, the Americans had been dropping cockles from the sea and that, and fish and food on the hillsides for the peasants to pick up, and trying to start an epidemic of different things. But we couldn't believe it. We took it with a pinch of salt, really. They had this exhibition going round. And with them, they had a photographer. And he was a Western chap. And he was an American photographer that had been captured in the front line. And they allowed him to keep his camera. He had a big flash camera, one of the old-fashioned ones. They allowed him to keep his camera, and he was coming round with these with these Chinese exhibition that was coming around, and taking photographs of different people in the camp. So, and it was being sent to the Western press to say how good we were being looked after. And of course he went off, and then we had one day a newspaper reporter came round. Two newspaper reporters came down. Westerners again. One had a Russian hat on, a big tall fella. And another one, I have seen him on the television since, spoke to us. I remember the first one, his name was Alan Winnington, and he wrote for the Daily Worker at the time. And the other chap, I can't remember his name.
Not Wilfred Burchett.
Wilfred Burchett, that was the chap. Yeah. He was with him as well, and they were talking to us and telling us, Winnington was telling us how the war was going and how the peace talks were going and things like that, you see. Now, the peace talks in the camp, we literally lived on them. Rumours spread, as there was with a lot of chaps, and one day your morale would be up, and one day it would be very, very low. All conditions were taken from the peace talks that were going on. Chinese would come and tell you one thing one day, saying that something's been signed and we're getting very close. And another day, they say, oh, the Americans never agreed with it, wouldn't agree with things. And your morale dropped again. This is how it was. It was their way of, I suppose, of controlling us. I don't know. And it was a sort of morale booster, and it was a morale dropper, more or less. We sort of lived for what we could hear about the peace talks, and that was a question every day on everyone's lips as time went on. How are the peace talks going? And if any Chinese interpreter had come down where they used to wander around the camp, that was the first question you usually asked the interpreter. How are the peace talks going? You hung on it, more or less. And he'd tell you different things and things like that. The following, we found that I was saying about the germs and the worms and that in the camp. We said that a lot of the germs were coming from this pit that was in the middle of the village. It was an old Korean latrine, right in the middle of the village. This is where the flies were coming from and everything like that. And we said, can we fill this pit in and build another one 100 yards away from the toilet? From the toilet in the middle of the village. And they said, yes, all right, we'll do that. They thought it was a good idea, the Chinese did. Thought it was a good idea that keep the flies away from the village, whatever there was there. And we dug this huge pit over on the edge of the football pitch at the time, on the corner of it, and there we built a westernized latrine. We went down to the village, and the old village sawman, we took logs down there, the old village saw chap on the saw, it was a funny saw, they saw with a two men saw there. There's a platform, and your saw is hung between the platform. Your log, I should say, is hung between the platform on the top of the, on the top where the one saw man stands with his feet astride on the two bars each side. And another chap is stood in a pit on the underneath the platform. There's a huge saw at the top that goes about a big 6-foot saw like a cross cut. And they start off, the top chap pulls the saw up, and the chap in the pit in the bottom pulls the saw down. There was no mechanical, it was all hand. And they saw our logs up and made planks for us. We collected the planks and we built a proper westernised toilet with a box over the top of the hole with holes for us to sit on, a line of four holes for anyone to sit on, and a urinal pit at the far end with a lid that came down over the hole to keep the flies out. And actually for us, it was lucky for us, because where we built this latrine, it was next, on the sides of the hills that were overlooking us, were all these fields. And the Korean use the affluents out of the pits to put on their fields. They use straight out of the latrines and the water, they use that. And you could always tell when the Koreans were emptying our latrine and the wind was in the wrong direction. You could always tell that because it blew right across the camp. But we didn't mind, because we knew that our pit was being cleaned, and the Koreans would do that for nothing, because it was they had a plentiful supply of manure for their fields, you see, and that was put on neat out of the pits. And from there, they produced these field turnips and things like that, other plants, which they supplied to parts of the camp in exchange for the affluent that we used to give them, I suppose. And they supplied the camp with turnips and cabbages and things like that, and to help with our own food.
Coming back to Winnington and Burchett, how were they received?
They were, well, with curiosity, more or less. And really, I suppose, as we've been in there so long, and we didn't know anything about, well, I didn't know anything about the Daily Worker at the time, that it was a communist paper, but I were told afterwards. But I mean, they were received with curiosity, really, because we wanted to find out what was going on in the peace talks. And they told us what they thought of it. And Winnington did say then, he said, I don't think it's going to last very much longer, which boosted our morale sky high, you can understand. He said, believe between you and me, he said, and what I know, he said, it's not going to last very long. This was the second year of our captivity when they came. It was getting, he came in the April, May of the April, I suppose. And in the June, we were all taken up onto the square. I'll never forget it. And we thought, oh yeah, another conference or another talk that the camp commandants give us. And by this time, these talks used to go on for so long that blokes used to get tired and they start sitting down on the gravel and that, and get damp ground and that. So everyone had made their own little stool out of a log and a plank of wood. Everyone had their own stool and they carried it everywhere. Whenever they sat down, they stuck the little stool down. You sat there and had a smoke and talked and stuck these little stools under you. We were all on the square that day, and the old camp commandant was smiling for once. He very, very seldom smiled. We never knew him. He never smiled the whole time we were there. He told us about what the Chinese were going to do. And he was smiling this day. Something's wrong. We thought something was wrong and all this sort of thing. And I don't know, he gave us a talk for a little while about the Chinese people's forces and things like that. And then he said, today, in Panmunjom, this was the words he said, today in Panmunjom, the peace talks have been signed. And I'll never forget it. In fact, I'm shaking now when I remember it. I don't know what the Chinese thought, but there was a hush went over everyone. It was electric. Nothing. And no one cheered. No one smiled. Not a person said a word. There was a hush. Not a word was said. And I suppose, I don't know whether the Chinese was to make us, was going to hear us, or going to make us shout and cheer or not, I don't know. But there wasn't a sound. Not a word. As if a great weight had been lifted off of our shoulders all the time we've been in the prison camp, with the morale going up and down, things like this. I suppose it was all of that built up. And I suppose some blokes had a few tears. I know I did when I got back to the camp. To think that we would be going home. Before that, about a month before, they repatriated a lot of the very seriously wounded. And we asked the Chinese at the time where they were going. And they said, we don't know, they're going to be taken to a Chinese hospital. Well, we thought, well, fair enough, you know. But unbeknown to us, they never told us that they were going to be exchanged for seriously wounded Chinese and North Korean troops on our side, which they called, it was Americans called the Little Switch, I think. And they were coming back to the camp. Got back to the camp, the hush broke. Everyone started talking at once. I'll never forget it. As long as I live, it's... When I think about it now, you know, it was such a relief. It was such a weight off of off my shoulders. And we were all the same, all quiet. And, oh dear. It still hits me now. We got back to the camp and all of a sudden everything broke. You could hear voices singing, voices shouting all over the camp. That night, no one could sleep. And then the question was, when are we going to be repatriated? They said, told us, we would all be repatriated within 2 weeks. We would be going out in batches until the camp was empty. After about a week, I was lucky enough to go out on the second batch that went out. The first batch, I remember, we went out and saw them, shook hands with the chaps. All these line of Russian-made lorries were on the main road to the camp. And we shook hands with the chaps and said we'd see them later on in Panmunjom. I went out on the second group. And they always left in the evening. It was usually evening time by the time we left. We piled onto the back of these open back Chinese Russian trucks and shook hands with the rest that was left behind and waved, telling we'd see them later on. Picked up our little bundles that we'd accumulated from books that the Chinese had gave us, and they gave us all a little present of a silk pillowcase each, with silk, all done in silk with flowers and flowers and birds and things like that, all done in silk on these little pillowcases. They gave me two. They gave each person had two, and I always forget it. Never forget it. As we went, the old camp commandant was waving us off as well, smiling. And all the soldiers, even the soldiers, were smiling at us. And I swear, one of the interpreters had tears in his eyes when he saw us go, I think. You know, because they hadn't been home, the Chinese interpreters hadn't been home for the whole duration of the war, I suppose. Once they got rid of us, they were going home as well. We got up into the mountains. It must have been 11 o'clock at night, I suppose. It was pitch black. And cut around this, we had to climb these mountains, and we were climbing for about 2 hours, I suppose, in these lorries. The engines were grinding and sliding. The motors were sliding. We go up one side of the mountains and these little tiny narrow tracks, about 10 foot wide, I suppose, wide enough for a truck to go along, and that was it. If anything came the other way, you couldn't get past. It must have been about 11 o'clock at night, I suppose. It was dark anyhow. Half asleep, I woke up. There was thunder and lightning crashing all around us. We were right up in the top, I suppose, and we started to descend to the other side. Lightning was crashing all around the lorries, and it was a terrible night, and it was raining heavily, very, very heavily. And we were proceeding down the other side of the mountain into the valley. We got down nearly to the valley, I suppose. I was half asleep. Everyone was half asleep in the back of the truck, but I can remember the lightning. All of a sudden, our truck's rear wheel started to scream. He couldn't get any grip on the side of this track. And on the right-hand side of us, I suppose in the darkness, what I found out afterwards, was a drop of about 200 feet on a gradual slope into a river at the bottom. The truck was slipping. We could tell it was slipping off the edge. Off the edge of this track. All of a sudden he lost his grip. And now everyone was sort of half asleep, half awake. And the truck lost it and started to roll down the side of this mountainside into the river below. We were all half asleep, semi-conscious. And unbeknown to us, as the truck rolled down over and over, we were being thrown out the back. I came round. I was unconscious, knocked unconscious. I came round about a metre from the river at the bottom, I suppose. And I don't know whether it's, when you go and try and save yourself, it's literally nature for you to get away from danger as quick as you can. And I found myself crawling uphill. I was semi-conscious. Blood was running down my head from a wound as well. It opened up once more. Although it healed, it had opened up because I knocked my head on the rocks and things like that as I was thrown out. You naturally, to save yourself, I started to crawl uphill. And by that time, the truck behind had stopped. The whole column had stopped, actually, and they came down to try and collect us all up. Lucky enough, no one was killed. Very lucky, no one was killed. And they took us back up to the top, and we had no bandages whatsoever. One chap had a white piece of cloth. He said, "Here, Frank, have this," or Nick, they used to call me Nick. "Have this," they said, and they wrapped it round my head into a white cloth bandage. In the meantime, four of our chaps that were in the truck and behind and went down and were trying to get the driver of the truck out of the lorry. They're up to their waist in water. And lucky enough, they were able to get the driver out, but the steering wheel had crushed his ribs, crushed his chest in. And they got him to the top, and they eventually levelled off this bit of ground. Someone was doing the digging, but I was sort of semi-conscious in this other truck, and we all were, except for whoever was out there trying to level this bit of ground off. It was still raining, but they must have dug a bit more out of the bank so that they could get the truck by. Come daylight, we was well down into the valleys again, travelling along through these valleys, and it was beautiful, beautiful sunshine. I'll never forget it. And as we go through these villages, the North Korean people in the village was waving as we went through, waving to us. I suppose they heard that the war was over. And of course, you wave back because you were on top of the world, you know. We arrived in Quezon, and we were told that we weren't going to be repatriated that night. We were to stop the night there, and we were going to be repatriated next morning. The prisoners were going to be exchanged the next morning, our batch for their batch. I'll never forget the meal that we had. The meal we had was exactly the same meal as the same day we were captured. Rice and beans that we had that night. No one could eat it. You were too excited. You thought about the thought of going out, getting out. I don't think anyone slept that night. People were talking well into the dark, well into the morning. I managed to doze off a bit because I was still a bit dopey from the knock on my head. Chinese looked at it, but they wrapped me back up again with this cloth that I was given. And next morning, about 10 o'clock, go everyone up, walk to the American trucks, other side of Quezon. We walked to these trucks that were all lined up along the road, driven by black soldiers. I'll never forget it. They were saying, "Hi, how you fellas, how you doing?" And when I looked at them, and I looked at us, I realized how much weight we'd lost. You don't realize it when you're all together, because weight loss is natural to all of you, and you all think everyone looks the same. But when we looked at these chaps, they were huge. We climbed onto their trucks, and they drove us to this American, huge American hangar. We had to go in one side of the hangar and out the other. All round inside was all the food that we hadn't had for years, for the couple of 3 years we were in there. All the food we could you could have. They deloused you as you went in the door, made you throw all your clothes away. And unlucky for me, some of the chaps didn't. They said, "Throw that away, the package I had with me, with all the little things that I'd collected over the years." I always regret it. Because, you know, I was probably wasn't thinking properly. Some of the chaps said, "No, I'm going to keep these packages," and they took them with them. But me, like a blooming fool, I chucked my parcel on the ground that I had, took all my clothes off, they deloused us, and walked on up, and you had another load of American clothes to put on as you went up through the hangar. Everyone picked up trousers for themselves, shirts and things like that. By the time you got out the other side of the hangar and you'd had your eat the food, when you'd had your food, you went out the other side and you were loaded onto some more trucks. These were driven by Canadian troops. And they were going to take us back to the Commonwealth camp further down in Korea, in towards Seoul. As I entered the hangar, getting back to that, as I entered the hangar, the American said to me, "What do you guys want?" See? And he was talking to me, guys, he was talking to me. And the only thing I could think about was ice cream. And I'd missed ice cream so long, he said, "There, fella, help myself." And he gave me a huge churn. And that's all I had in there. I ate this ice cream, I suppose, until I was sick of it. And I really wanted it. And that was the only food I ate there in that hangar. I'd regress. I just wanted this ice cream. I don't know why. Anyway, we came out, loaded onto these Canadian-driven lorries. And on each lorry was